For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome.
Good evening.
Thank you for coming out through the snow and cold and all. I'm very happy tonight to have speaking for us Libby Bachhuber. Some of you who come Mondays and not Sundays may not know Libby because she comes Sundays and not Mondays usually, but I'm glad she's here thanks to the lineage of presidents of whatever this is. Libby is one of our reliable doans, is on our promotions committee, and is also a member of our Ethics and Reconciliation Council, somebody who's available for help with situations that arise. So Libby's also one of our Sangha's various psychotherapists. So thank you, Libby, for coming and talking.
Thank you for inviting me. Hi, I know most of you, not all of you, but this is my first time doing a Dharma talk, and it's just been a nice experience to try to put my thoughts together. So I wanted to talk about something that I think about a lot. It's sort of a central issue for me in my practice. And it's the question of what it means to bring our practice into our everyday lives. And particularly, I'm thinking about situations that we experience as difficult in some way. So that covers the whole range from micro kinds of situations, like just, you know, irritations, paying the bills, to, you know, relational issues, interpersonal issues, maybe complex issues at work that involve multiple players and questions. And then even all the way out to macro issues of, you know, social concerns, social justice, environmental issues. So obviously that's a huge territory, but I think what unites all those situations is that they involve a lot of thinking and feeling, and, you know, sort of multiple issues that we're trying to sort through. And they can feel demanding, confusing, triggering, you know, bringing up a lot of feelings, and that in all of them we can find that some of our maybe familiar emotional patterns get kicked up, so some of our familiar struggles. And so even though we may know as Zen students that our practice, you know, reaches into every nook and cranny of our lives, theoretically, that everything is included. And that practice, you know, is about something very essential and basic about who we are and our inseparability from all that is. Yet, when we find ourselves navigating some of these kinds of thorny situations, all the so-called truths that we may have been in touch with on the cushion can seem really far away. Again, this is a question I think about a lot, and you know, there's so much that could be said about it. And I also imagine each one of us has our own experience of it, so I'll be looking forward to just hearing whatever thoughts you might want to share when it's time for that. Which, by the way, you'll help me know what the timing is.
Okay.
Or do you want me to have that near me?
We can share it, and I can. I'll signal you when it's time to.
Okay. What should I be looking at?
Like 8:30 or so.
Okay. Thanks. And then we'll start the discussion. Okay. So I thought I would start with talking a little about just my perspective, you know, or one way of talking about practice itself and what is discovered there, and then kind of bridge to these other difficult situations. So what happens when we sit? So obviously we have a lot of practices, but I'm thinking about sitting practice as kind of our core practice. So when we sit, you know, one way of talking about that experience is that it's sort of like a back and forth. I know for myself, that's how I experience it. And, you know, that, you know, I sit down and there's a familiarity of the intention of, oh yeah, here I am, you know, just facing the wall and just being with what's happening. And then within, you know, seconds, the mind kicks up and there's some daydream that happens, some worry, you know, some line of thought and feeling that kicks up. And it sort of, you know, takes over for a little while. And then there's a remembering that happens, like, oh yeah, I'm here. I'm not outer space land. I'm actually just right here. And here's this wall, and here's this feeling of sitting here. Here's the sensations in the body. Here's the sounds around me. And I return to just being alive right here. And I kind of remember, oh yeah, there's nothing to do. This isn't actually time for thinking and figuring stuff out. You know, that's not what I'm here to do. I'm here to just be here. And you know, in Zen practice, we're not pushing too hard on that effort. We're not trying to be a certain way. But there's just an opportunity that occurs in the structure of sitting where all there is us and this wall. And so there isn't really another task at hand. And so there's an opportunity to just notice what it's like to be alive right now rather than, you know, focusing on some goal. So there's this back and forth that happens. So I remember, oh yeah, I'm here. And then, you know, instant later, another thought stream comes up, I'm away. And then I remember again, oh yeah, I'm here. So that's one way of talking about the experience of sitting. And this sort of dream and then awaking up from the dream. Back and forth. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with the thinking and the thought streams, but it's just that, again, there's something that becomes available when we sit and kind of look or experience beneath the level of thought. Okay, so then if that's a way of talking about or imagining, you know, what our experience of sitting is, then what... is it, you know, how do we translate that into situations where there actually is something to figure out, where the task at hand is not just being, but the task is, you know, figuring out our taxes or trying to interact with someone who we're having a difficult time interacting with. You know, even with something like, let's say, paying the bills or taxes or something, where that's in some ways very basic, you know, it can, I know for myself, it can feel triggering and it can feel like, you know, annoying, stressful, and so it can feel as if it's antithetical to practice. And I find myself in those situations having thoughts like, ugh, why do I have to be doing this? I wish my life were simpler. I wish I didn't have to deal with situations like this. And maybe I fantasize like, oh, I wish I had, you know, why can't I live like a village or something where people don't have, you know, the way we were meant to live or some fantasy about, you know, how it's supposed to be, as if I know how it's supposed to be. And, you know, and I, as a footnote, I actually joined the Peace Corps and lived in a village for 2 years, partly because I kind of wanted to get a firsthand sense of, like, what is that actually about? You know, is that how we're supposed to, is that, like, better in some way? And the short answer is, no, people suffer in villages. And not just from poverty, but from, you know, the usual social intrigues. So that was my experience, at least. Maybe there's some other village where people don't suffer. But, you know, or the other fantasy thought I have is, you know, oh, you know, I've been practicing so long. Why do I still get so annoyed about stuff like this? You know, I should transcend this situation. I should be peaceful right now. You know, there's nothing wrong right now. I should just feel fine and good and peaceful. while I'm doing the taxes. So, or while I'm procrastinating about doing the taxes. So the experience that I'm having in a moment like that is like, it's as if being involved in a task like that and having all the attendant thoughts and feelings are problems in and of themselves. That there's something wrong with that experience. And yet, as Zen students, again, we know that that's not, that can't be true. You know, that's not actually our practice. To reject experiences and you know, categorize what's okay and what's not okay. We know this, and yet we forget it, I think. I know I do. So I want to look a little more deeply at what's going on in those situations, what gets so confusing, and what is the nature of that suffering that we may be experiencing, that I'm experiencing. And so, you know, I think what we sort of know and what we learn over time in our practice is that what's really anchoring us in suffering at those times is this habit of self-involvement. The illusion that we are a separate self, you know, separate from the world around us, that is potentially in danger and is maybe threatened somehow by the situation and in need of protection, and then we have to kind of anxiously work to maintain something and fend off evil and, you know, protect things being the way we want them to be, or somehow make them the way that we want them to be. Suzuki Roshi, in this book, refers to it in one line that I'll quote in a minute. He refers to that as our small self. Sort of the illusion of the small self. So in these situations, we're feeling some version of, oh no, you know, poor little me, I'm under attack, you know, and I better work really hard to make sure everything works out for me. And so then when that gets kicked up, all of our thinking and feeling in that situation gets shaped by that. That kind of that sense of things. So on the emotional level, it feels bad. It feels like suffering. And on the cognitive level, on the level of thinking, it represents a kind of distortion where the whole wide, mysterious world gets shrunken down to this narrow question of what I feel like will help me maximize pleasure and minimize pain. And, you know, human beings around us become objects that we need to manipulate and somehow make work in a certain way that will keep things safe for us and hopefully help things end up in a way that we want them to. And so our ability to just be awake creatures who are participating, you know, openly and bravely and helpfully in the world is compromised. And so I thought I would just kind of make this a little concrete by, I was referencing finances because for different reasons, that's actually been an issue that's been on my mind a lot lately. And I found myself worrying. So I was going to just share this example from my life that I've been worrying more about finances. And, you know, this is an interesting issue. You know, it's a tricky issue, and actually all these kinds of issues, all the issues are tricky when you really look at them. You see these sort of paradoxes inside of them or confusions where, in a certain way, it feels like, yeah, I have to worry about my finances. This is important, you know, that I need to be able to, and I think there is a truth to it, that we need to take responsibility for our livelihood and to make sure that, you know, things are kind of, that we're facing the truth of the questions of, you know, can we support this being to continue to exist in the world, you know, with food and shelter and whatever that, you know, now and in the future. And those are important questions. But there But, you know, we begin to notice, or I know for myself as I've practiced with this issue over time, painfully, is that I've noticed the part of that or the layer of that that's not just the simple question of how do I stay alive in the world and take responsibility, but also that, again, that layer of, what if things don't work out for me? You know, I thought my life was supposed to feel like this, and I wanted it to look this way, and I wanted to have these things. And, you know, it's been very humbling to notice that in myself, because I never thought of myself as someone who cared. I don't particularly care terribly much about material things and economic what have you, but I've noticed, there is this part of me that definitely feels threatened and wants things to be the way I want them to be. And a lot of suffering is created there. And so a lot of extra anxiety gets layered on to sort of basic questions of like, okay, how am I going to handle, you know, these questions? So bringing it back to just thinking about this more generally, so the quote from Suzuki Roshi that is from this book that I was just referencing, he says, when we're trying to be active and special and accomplish something, we cannot express ourselves. Small self will be expressed, but big self will not appear from the emptiness. From the emptiness, only great self appears. And he's focusing here on, he says, when we're trying to be active and special and accomplish something, I'm also including, and thinking about the situation where when we are trying to be maybe not active and special and accomplish something, but even just when we're trying to protect, and, you know, there's when we're coming from more of a fearful stance. So I think there's sometimes we're coming from maybe a prideful stance and other times sort of fearful. But both of them represent this kind of small self that's only able to be expressed. And he's making the distinction about what it means to kind of drop that and come from emptiness and what becomes possible there. So I think when I think about practicing with all of this, one way to think about it is just waking up again and again to the reality of this self-serving mechanism, of the small self, you know, over and over and over again, that we get lost in it, it takes over, and then there's the opportunity to just remember, oh yeah, I'm just here. I'm not under attack. I feel like I'm under attack. But I'm just here. And we can return to reality, even just for an instant, to return to reality as it is. And this, the woman who wrote this book, Charlotte Joko Beck, who's another Zen teacher, who I have gained very much from, says it in, she talks about that movement from, in a way, the small self to the big self. She talks about that as, in one of her lectures, she's quoting actually another book, but she uses the term getting in and out of the box. She says our whole practice, in a way, is about getting in and out of the box. And the box she's referring to is the small self, is that constrained, worried, you know, self-serving place. And so the opportunity is to, you know, when we find ourselves being able to get out of the box, it means just dropping it, releasing our grip on this dream, and returning to what's right in front of us. Sort of shifting, in a way, it's like shifting what's in the foreground. That the small self will always be with us, but it's sort of how we're relating to it or attending to it. And this is very difficult, as we all know. So, you know, the self-serving habit is deeply, deeply powerful, deeply rooted, incredibly powerful. And again, another thing that Charlotte Jokobak says about it is, we love our box. In a way, it's our favorite place to be. It's so familiar, you know, and we don't want to get out of the box. It's kind of scary, actually, to be in the emptiness for any length of time. And it just feels unfamiliar. It's just, you know, the box is our kind of home base. It feels that way, at least. You know, and then we have the fact that so many messages around us in our society and our friends and family can reinforce the idea that, oh, no, you want to get what's good for you, you know? Just that's what it's all about. And, you know, get rid of what's bad and go towards what's good. And it's not that there's anything wrong with that, but it just gets very confusing. And so it just feels, because it just feels very, it ends up feeling very natural that when things feel hard, all we can think to do is resent what's happening and either fight it or shut down. And it takes enormous effort, at least for me, to remember that that whole approach is unnecessary and not useful and perpetuates our suffering. And so even to remember that there's another way to be in the world can be difficult. And then if we can remember it, I know, again, for myself, it can be incredibly difficult to actually decide to drop it and move out of the box. It takes actually enormous effort, especially at times when we're very, very triggered. I use that word triggered a lot, obviously. And I think the other thing that gets confusing about this is that we sometimes have idealized notions about how this whole practice thing is going to go. And so, again, you know, I'm sitting there doing my taxes or what have you, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm stressed. Oh, let me, you know, practice with this. Let me try to drop it. And it's like, wait, it's not working, you know? I don't actually feel any better. I'm still so tense, you know? And I'm mad at myself because why aren't I good enough at practicing and whatever. Some idea I have about how this is supposed to feel. So in some ways this box metaphor, I think it's clarifying, but it can also be, it can reinforce that idea that there's an in and there's an out, there's a good and there's a bad. And whereas the reality of this is not so simple, that it's almost as if there's sort of a spectrum that, you know, of how in the box we are, how deluded. And again, you know, when we're in reality of complex situations, again, if you think about like being in a work situation or a situation where there's multiple people involved, multiple questions, time pressures, you know, there's a lot going on. The idea that you would somehow be able to just drop the whole self-serving mechanism and just, you know, be fully present to all of it and move through it beautifully, you know, it's a lovely idea, but I think it's a lot to ask of ourselves, you know. And so a different way that Charlotte Jokobak talks about this is she acknowledges that a different way to talk about it is it's not necessarily getting out of the box. It's exploring what it's like to be in the box. It's sort of waking up to that reality, like, whoa, what's it like to feel really tense? And what's it like to feel irritated and this strain and this, you know, over-focus on certain variables and, wow, look at what's happening. You know, and trying to just wake up to that for just milliseconds at a time. And it may not yield... Again, it may not yield some sea change in our experience in the moment where all of a sudden we feel fantastic and we're relating beautifully and we're the person we always wanted to be. But I do feel like over time, as I've struggled with this, slowly there are subtle, you know, openings that have happened over time, where it's just, I just over the years, maybe I'm less deluded than I used to be overall for less percentage of the time. Maybe. So it's not about trying to achieve something or achieve some perfect state. And not even to have a more peaceful life. Or to be a better person, you know, all these ideas that we have about where practice is going to get us. You know, all of those ideas represent more of the small me's take on life. Like, oh, I know, you know, I'm going to have this cool life where I'm a good person and I don't have, you know, suffer as much and I'm more open and whatever. Those are the small me trying to create a life that's going to be the way it wants it to be. But if we truly engage with the world and we kind of make that vow that we are going to be as honest as we can be with what's really happening, it's going to be messy. There's just no way to have relationships and take on responsibilities and try to do good in the world. And face into the very real and very disturbing and difficult large-scale issues like economic disparities and racism and environmental degradation. You know, if we're going to open up to all the realities of our lives, and even just our relationships with our loved ones, you know, all of it involves suffering in ourselves, in others, difficult questions, unresolvable dilemmas, and just complexity of infinite variables that are somewhat abstract and hard to sort out and are just never ending. And so, you know, when we take on this practice of like wanting to have a life where we engage honestly with what's happening, it's a long haul that we're, you know, it's not something that we can find the right magic wand to wave and it's all going to work. This is a lifetime of practice. So I'm coming to the end here. So I think what it means to practice in that context, again, is just sort of finding a way to touch in again and again and again to the here and now, to open up to our actual experience of being here with these complex issues. And that can mean coming, you know, just back to our visceral experience, sound, feeling, you know, sensation. Checking in with ourselves, where am I at? You know, this upsetness I'm feeling, how does it feel? Can I go deeper into my experience for a moment beneath the level of all this thought and worry? Can I find the part of me that's beneath the level of the self-centered worries, the beneath the level of the small self? Maybe loosen my grip a bit on that sense of guilt or anxiety or overwhelm or, you know, whatever I'm obsessing, that obsessive tendency, that feeling of I'll never be able to get this just right, I'll never be able to make enough of a difference, or, you know, this will never all work out. Can I just for a moment, or just for an instant, touch into what's just happening right now, what's real, and then engage again with the matters at hand? And all of this with that sense, you know, in the context of there is, you know, the point is not to achieve some perfect way of being. It's just to keep going, to be as truthful and honest and humble as we can, not to accomplish what the small self thinks it needs to accomplish or protect what it thinks it needs to protect. What Suzuki Roshi says again in this book at a different place is about this question of what's the point of all this? You know, what can we expect from this practice? He says, so the point on each moment is to forget the point and extend your practice. So he's using here the idea that, you know, in a way that we can use just it's like, forget about where you think you're going to get to. Just use practice itself as your anchor. You know, just this effort to find the truth, to be with truth for its own sake. And that maybe that is a way to anchor ourselves in all of this complexity. And I guess the last thing I just wanted to quote was another Charlotte Jokobek quote about this, which is that practice is all about developing courage, that when these things hit your life, you stay steady. You may not at first, but after a while, you steady down and face it.
Thank you. So thank you very much, Libby, for expressing your expression of the dynamics of practice. Lovely. Comments, questions, responses for Libby, please. Ben.
Well, thank you so much for that eloquent, I don't even know what the noun would be, but thanks. talk, I guess. I kept thinking of something that I read and I forget and who it attributed to, but a guy goes up to the mountaintop and he says, Master Zen guy at the mountaintop, I have all these problems, my wife and I don't get along, and I have an old Gimpy war room and blah blah blah, and he goes through 63 problems. He goes, help me. And the Zen master goes, nah, I can't. And so the guy says, well, what good are you then? Why did I climb this mountain for? And the master says, well, can I help you with your 64th problem, not wanting to have any problems? And I just kept thinking about that through, it seemed to be a thing in your talk, like how to get rid of that 64th problem or how to deal with it. And there are a couple of themes in your talk you referenced quite effectively, I thought, how to deal with or the kind of dynamics in dealing with kind of active intrusions from like the outside or from that are generated within yourself. I'm wondering if you have any insight into how to deal with ones that are more trying to choose among different things to deal with. So if you're thinking about a period of time that suddenly opened up your day or something, and you want to devote it to improving something, like how, and there are 10 trillion ways to do that, and there are lots of situations where there's infinite choices, like infinite variables that they can reference to your child. Can you give your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's such an interesting situation. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I mean, I feel like I've experienced that myself, and I don't have a great insight into it, because I feel like I've struggled with that, and it was actually a different angle I thought about taking with this in terms of, you know, what does it mean to face into questions that are more abstract, like you said, and that's one way of putting it. Another version of that is, how do I use my life? Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many things that need support, and there's so many parts of me that I could work on, and, you know, how do we answer those questions? You know, and obviously, I guess the only slice on it that I would offer would be about like washing out for the part of you that, or us, that may be pressured in that situation because we want to do it right, or, you know, whatever ideas we have about, again, how our, the small self stuff, you know, how my life is supposed to be. So trying to attend to what is actually happening inside of us around that, that may be then creating a barrier or inhibition to us moving forward in a more natural way and responding to what feels right. But I don't know that there's any straightforward, you know, I mean, my feeling about that is in some ways it's kind of a problem of our time. It's like, oh, so many opportunities, you know, and there isn't, it's not just about responding to what's right in front of us. You know, we really do have more abstract questions that there aren't easy ways to answer. But I don't know. I'd be curious what anyone else might say about that.
Other comments or questions, please? Time for one or two more. Well, just, I appreciate what you just said. You know, one thing is to, when there's 10,000 things coming up, just whatever's next, you know, just kind of respond to that. Sometimes they seem dizzying. So I think you're right, there's not one easy answer. Other questions or comments?
Yes.
Sarah.
The fear is a very tricky emotion for me. And knowing when, because sometimes it can be very helpful in cluing me into when there is something that I need to protect myself from or look at it in a different way. But then other times it's more of the small self kind of fear. So I don't know if you had any thoughts about when kind of the function that fear can play, or how to relate to fear in a way that is not only small self-based and not just trapping.
So for me, where I've gone with that is, this applies to fear, but it applies to other kinds of, just those kinds of emotions. But I know I have my own, you know, anxiety is a common one for me. So I try to, if I can catch myself, I try to then, you know, kind of steady myself and ask myself, like, okay, what is your best sense of what is going on right now? You know, what do I need to see here? And you know, I'm understanding that there's some distortion going on, I may be exaggerating, but is there some core, is there something important I need to attend to here? Mm-hmm. Certainly wanting to attend to it, you know, and not just say, oh, whatever, you know, let's pretend there's no problems in the world. It's like, no, sometimes you need to be serious and deal with something, you know. But the anxiety part, you know, there's always that extra layer where it's not helping you actually attend to it effectively. So you also have to be able to access your strength in order to be able to, you know, deal with a threat or whatever, a difficult situation. So anyway, that phrase, what's my best sense, has become kind of an anchor for me to try to discern in the midst of difficult, distracting feelings.
Thank you. So, any last comment or question? Bill.
I wanted to go to the work situation in particular. I mean, and one thing I struggle with, and I wonder too, when you went to the village in the Peace Corps, did you think it would sort of simplify your life almost in a kind of quasi-monastic kind of way? Because I think that's one of the hardest things is that, I mean, I live a very complicated life, and most of my attempts to simplify things just make it worse usually. And I know a lot of it's my own fault, but, you know, like more and more when I go into the classroom, and I don't know, I know you're a therapist, right? I mean, mm-hmm. so, I don't know, maybe this is one of those old, the presentation of self in everyday life kind of questions, but I know I don't really like presenting myself in the classroom so much anymore, because I have to do it in a certain way or it's just not going to be effective. If I could take a cushion in there and just sit on the desk and talk at the pace that a Dharma talk would go, you know, I actually think it would be better, and it would actually be better for the students, but it would also be roundly rejected and criticized and revolted against. And,
poor professor.
Yeah, it's rough. And I don't know. I just, it's more, as a more general question, it's sort of that we're not monastics, and so we're out there in the world and we're having to present ourselves in different situations in ways that maybe we don't really want to, but there's not really... or am I just making an excuse? I mean, maybe I should just bite the bullet and go with, you know, a more Zen approach, you know, to every situation. But maybe I just don't know how to do that. It just, that's something that's raised for me by what you what you said.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. That's a great example of this complexity and no easy answer kind of thing, where in some ways we have this ideal in our head of how it would be if our lives were only Zen-like or whatever. Right, I mean, I feel like each one of us has to discern this within the context of our own situations of... You know, so like the question you're raising for yourself is, you know, what would it mean? You know, is there a way for me to be more who I am in a way where I feel more grounded or more connected to who I am and more attuned, but at the same time attuned to what's around me? You know, because we all have to fill different roles when we, you know, when I go to the bank versus when I'm a therapist versus when I'm at home, like, you know, I'm in a different role and there's a reality to that and I'm respectful of the context, you know, but at the same time, again, there's some layer that often gets added of like, oh, what if I don't live up to other people's ideas of how I'm supposed to be or whatever. So, you know, again, noticing that part that's like, yeah, maybe there is a way I'm frightened. I'm adding a layer of anxiety that's creating a barrier to me just being present and doing what's needed, you know?
Just to add one piece to this, which isn't going to solve any problems, but in terms of the way you were presenting things, which I really appreciated, another part of it is that we're not exactly trying to get rid of our small self.
Right.
It's not about getting rid of the ego. So we have these various roles, you know, professor or therapist or teacher or whatever. And so in some sense, that's the stuff we work with. And it's really not separate from that big self. Right in the middle of the situation. So the practice is to see how we are acting out these roles, part of the practice anyway, is to see that and for you to see your own resistance to being the professor and having to give this wonderful, you know, discourse. The more you see that box that you're trying to fit into and the way in which you as your small self has learned a routine and a way of doing that, it's not exact. Sometimes some pieces of it just fall away, but mostly it's how do we work in there in a way that has a wider sense, that we can try something different, that we can be more flexible, that we can shift how we usually present ourselves in that sense, because we recognize that that quote unquote ourselves is just, you know, kind of illusion. Anyway, I don't know if that helps, but just wanted to add that to what you were saying, and I really appreciated your presentation, and we'll all continue to keep struggling with all of this forever. But we'll end with the four Bodhisattva vows tonight.
Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are